For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah. Well, Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, we read, and early in the morning he came again to the temple, and all the people were sat around him, and he sat down and began to teach. It was the Mount of Olives right across from Jerusalem. He went up the valley, came out, this big temple area. There could be thousands of people here. This thing is, I don't know, 10 football fields or more. It's huge. Still there today, the Temple Mount area where he would have been teaching. The temple's gone. It's probably sitting on the steps there. Notice something in your Bibles from 7 verse 53 down past 8:11. There are either brackets around this passage or the passage might be in italics. And as the NLT note says, the most ancient Greek manuscripts do not include this passage. This passage is known in theology as the pericope adultère. It's a segment. It's got this story in it, and that's it. Very interesting textual debate on this. It's not in the three best manuscripts we have for John are all 4th century manuscripts. And late 4th, mostly. None of them have this story in it. However, the story was there earlier. If we go back, there are other witnesses to the fact that this story was originally in the Gospel of John. The Didascalia is an early church training piece from 230 AD, and it refers to this story as being in John. So that's before any of those good manuscripts we have, by 100 years or more. The Apostolic Constitution in 300s talks about it. Papias, very early, 120. The book of John written maybe 95. So, I mean, the ink was still wet, practically. This guy had said that he had sat under John, that he had heard John teach when he was a boy, had sat and heard him teach. Papias, discipler, Polycarp, had been discipled by John. So he's that close to the source. And he refers to a woman cast in front of Christ and accused of sin. It's got to be this story. There's nothing else like that. He knew about it. Now, unfortunately, we don't have Papias's book, his 5-volume commentary on the Gospels anymore. All we have are citations of Papias by a bunch of other church fathers, and in this case, Eusebius, the author of church history. But scholars are all, you know, it's very clear that this work by Papias did exist, that it was very early. And so that's a very early witness to this passage. Didymus the Blind, his cache of notes in Alexandria, Egypt, were discovered in 1941, and he had a sermon in there based on this passage. Ambrose in 375. Jerome, the translator of the Latin Vulgate, around 400, said that many manuscripts, and here's his actual statement, in the Gospel according to John, in many manuscripts, both Greek and Latin, is found the story of the adulterous woman who was accused before the Lord. So, he is contemporaneous or just slightly behind our earliest and best manuscripts. But the three that we have are three out of several thousands that have been lost. So when you have this whole chorus of people talking about this passage in the second and third century, you know, the passage was there. And the fact that it didn't survive. Now, here's another strange thing about this little chunk, this little story, is that it shows up here in John. Then it also shows up in some manuscripts in other places in John or at the end of the book, like tacked on, like it obviously doesn't belong at the end of the story. It doesn't fit there at all. But what you can tell, it's been detached from where it belongs and put at the end. It's even in one case found in the book of Luke. What you have here is a case of document tampering. And this is exactly what Augustine says in the late 300s. He says, certain persons of little faith, or rather enemies of the true faith, fearing, I think, lest their wives should be given impunity in sinning, removed from their manuscripts the Lord's act of forgiveness toward the adulteress, as if he who had said, sin no more, had granted permission to sin. But think about it. What you have in this story is a woman caught in adultery gets away scot-free. That didn't sit right with the highly legalistic tone of the early post-apostolic church. Got very legalistic very quick. For example, an early church piece in the early 200s by a guy named Hermas was called The Shepherd of Hermas. In it, he suggests that if a woman committed adultery, she could be forgiven like once. But if she did it again, then, you know, forget it. You're going to hell. For saying that, he was bitterly cut down by other church fathers for being too liberal. And Tertullian refers to his work as the shepherd of adulterers, because he's like implying that you could actually be forgiven for adultery. That's how legalistic things got within 100 years of Jesus. Grace was the first thing out. That was the first thing that disappeared in the early church. And this story is raw, radical grace. And I think that Augustine's probably right here. And the pattern, the way that it shows up in different positions, particularly, that just shows you right there that we have a loose leaf. You know, they've basically got this on a separate loose leaf so that, you know, the kids don't read it because it's a dirty story. And they can't decide where to put it. They don't quite want to throw it away because it's authentic. But they, are moving it. I think it belongs. The majority of scholars today do not. And I'm in the minority here, although a number of well-respected scholars agree that it is does belong. And I think also that even a lot of the ones that say that it's not a part of John, think that it is an actual historic event. Now, how you could get that, if this was fabricated and put into John, you know, hundreds of years after the fact, how could it be an authentic and historical event? I think it had to be written. Also, the thought flow of John, you know, judge for yourself. He's talking about judging with unrighteous judgment, which we read last week in 7. He comes back to that later in this 8, next week. And it's always this theme of unrighteous judgment. And this story perfectly fits John's pattern of telling a story and then explaining and expanding on the meaning of it. I mean, it just fits here. I don't think it's improper at all. And Jerome, who was a very careful scholar, fluent in Hebrew and in Greek, as well as Latin, had the manuscripts because the church commissioned him to make this translation. And he left his church and went out by himself in his shed to like write this. And they supplied him with all these manuscripts. He was very familiar with the manuscript evidence. And for him to say that many Greek and Latin manuscripts had this story in John. And also, one other point. Augustine and Jerome didn't get along with each other. They were contemporaries. And so when they both agree on something, that's a pretty good sign. Because they tended to disagree a lot of the time. Anyway, I'm treating it as though it's authentic, and I think it is. I think the other thing that fits here, what fits is Jesus. You read this story about Jesus and see if you don't think that it's him. I mean, you can just tell it's him. Well, so here he is. He's on the steps. Here's a big crowd gathered around. You know, these crowds went up into the thousands sometimes. He's teaching. And the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery. And having set her in the midst, they probably threw her into the midst on the ground there. They said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery in the very act." Now, the law of Moses says, commands us to stone such a woman. What then do you say? Oh, now they've got him. And when they were saying this, John says they were testing him in order that they might find grounds for accusing him. Oh, yeah, it's a very dangerous situation with everybody watching. Jesus stoops down and with his finger writes on the ground. Isn't that interesting? We're going to go back and reread this. I'm just going to read it one time. When they persisted and asking him, finally he stands up and he said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Then he stooped back down and starts writing on the ground again. When they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones. And eventually he was left alone with the woman where she was in the midst. She's not alone like there's no, the crowd is still there. But in the center, it's just him and the woman left now. These accusers have just been like, and took off. Straightening up, Jesus says to her, "Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you?" She says, "No one, Lord." And Jesus says, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on, sin no more." That's a really cool little story. Very cool. Let's go back and take this apart. Okay, back to three again. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery and set her in the midst. And they said to him, "Teacher, this woman's been caught in adultery in the very act." They caught her in bed. Oh, well, now the story, this story stinks right off the bat. The law, which they're quoting, the law of Moses says this or that. Yeah, it does say that in the very ancient law of Moses. And adultery was a capital crime. It's interesting, in the law of Moses, you know, it's very lenient on crimes against property, like theft, where in the ancient world you could have your hands cut off if you stole, or you could be executed if you stole stuff from a noble. In the Old Testament, you know, when you steal something, you have to give it back. And you have to pay 20% fine of the value of what you stole. It's very lenient, extraordinarily lenient. And a lot of things are that way, quite lenient. But when it comes to things either that break down the family or that break down the people of God and the spirituality of the people of God, very harsh and capital punishment. Which sounds pretty strange to us today to think of capital punishment for adultery when, you know, in our culture, adultery is whatever, sexual preference, it's my business, it's none of your business. And, you know, it was even strange back then. Even in Jesus' day, it was already strange. This law had not been enforced for hundreds of years, and we're certain of that. So they're bringing up this law that nobody follows, okay, and they're throwing this in front of him. But in Deuteronomy, it's very clear. If somebody has caught in adultery, you bring them both forward. Where is the man? If she was caught in the very act, he must have been right there. And yet they show up only with the woman. Immediately, Jesus obviously looked at this scene and discerned this is a setup. This woman is being used as the fall woman here, and their own story is self-contradictory. If they caught her in the act, they would have that man right there, and instead, it's just her. This is stinky. Well. They say in the law of Moses, we're commanded to stone such women. What do you say? Well, when John points out they're saying this so they might have grounds of accusing him, the grounds, what they're doing here is pretty transparent. If he rejected the Old Testament law and said, "Oh, you know, we haven't been following that. I don't think we need to do that," then this is not only could be discrediting because he's denying the Old Testament that everyone believed in, but it's also illegal to cut down in any way the Old Testament scriptures in that society. The Sanhedrin could have you arrested for that, beaten, and imprisoned. On the other hand, if he says, well, yeah, it says there, so yeah, we should get her, then he's violating Roman law, which would be even worse. The Romans didn't permit executions by the Jews, and everyone knew that. So if he called for that, then he could be reported to the Romans for violating the rules. And it didn't take much under Roman law to end up in a galley ship as a slave the rest of your life or hanging from a gibbet. So they basically are going to use this. No matter what he says, it's going to be used against him. And we sit here and we think to ourselves, whoa, this is a pretty elaborate trap. I don't know what he's going to say here. And so we have the very surprising thing that he does. Stoops down and he wrote on the ground. Never seen him do anything like this before. Never seen him do it again. Like, this action itself is pretty unusual. And of course, there's probably dust there, so he's writing in the dust. Wonder what he was writing. Wouldn't that be interesting? John doesn't give us that part. Was he quoting Deuteronomy where it prescribes the death penalty for anyone who conspires to bring an Israelite to an unjust trial, like they're doing? Or maybe he wrote, thou shalt not bear false witness, one of the Ten Commandments. Bearing false witness at a trial, direct violation of law, just as big a direct, you know, that's a violation, just like adultery is a violation. Maybe he could just even write, thou shalt not commit adultery, because how convenient is it that here in the middle of the day, they just happen to catch some woman committing adultery in the act. They probably found a prostitute and sent their own guy in there. Or they're even lying. And it's not even true. But if it is true that she was in adultery, they probably hired her out, and their accessories before and after the fact, they're just as guilty as she is, the whole crew of them. If this is what it appears to be, which is a conspiracy to use this woman to get Christ, and that's all it is, they're as guilty as anything she did. Really, what she did is more understandable, you know. Because if she's a prostitute, or maybe even she had a lover. But here, what they're doing is just based on hate and the desire to kill. We know that they were already eager to see Jesus dead. Or, I know what you did last summer. That was a movie a few years back. Maybe he wrote the name of the man who should have been right there beside her. It was like, I know him. Now, one of you who is without sin can throw the first stone. He sure probably wrote something down there that convicted and showed that they were in sin and that he knew it. And not just any sin, but that they were in sin in the context of this duplicitous, dirty, filthy effort to use a helpless woman and to cut Jesus down. Well, when they persisted in asking him, he finally straightens up and he says to them, let him who is out sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. That's a famous passage. You know, have you ever heard the expression, who's throwing the first stone? Who's casting the first stone? It's from this story. Yeah. To throw the first stone means that you think you're more righteous than other people. You're righteous enough to attack them. But, you know, again, in the context here, it's not just that they're guilty of some sin. It's that they're guilty in this situation of doing something highly dishonest and dirty to this woman. And then he stoops back down a road again. Oh, I would have loved to have been there that day. This is so dramatic. And now they're just left standing there, you know, with their stones. And first the older men, maybe they were quicker to realize they had been checkmated here. Maybe it was the younger men that had the idea to try this, and some of the older guys weren't into it. I don't know why they went out first. Finally, though, they all drop their stones and walk away. That must have been hugely embarrassing for him. They thought they had Jesus boxed into the corner here, where he could do nothing but something that was going to be highly damaging, and instead they were damaged. I bet they were really pissed about this whole episode. Then we come down to the punchline of the story. Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you? She said, no one, Lord. And he comes back with this remarkable statement, neither do I condemn you. This is why, in all likelihood, some of the early church fathers, as Augustine suggests, didn't like this story. It's because it's too soft on adultery. And they were really hung up about that. So this kind of reminds you, doesn't it? You know, it's like, neither do I condemn you. He kind of puts his acceptance or condemnation up on a pretty high level here. Like what I think is what matters. And so it's very reminiscent of other episodes. I don't know if you've read the story in Mark 2 where they lowered a paralytic man down through the roof in front of where Jesus was teaching. And all of his critics and the religious leaders were sitting there watching him. And he says to the man, instead of saying, you know, you're healed and healing him, he says, your sins are forgiven. And they were like, oh, and everyone's like, what? This guy's saying he can forgive sins? Nobody can do that but God. And Jesus asked them a question. He says, yeah, well, which would be harder? To say that his sins are forgiven or to say stand up and walk? This guy's been paralyzed for 30 years. See, now in their theology, which was not biblical, but what they believed, and we have this teaching in preserved to us in the teachings of the rabbis. They believed for a guy to be paralyzed like this, that he deserved that because of sin. And so to say you can stand up and walk, to heal a man, you would have to forgive the sin. And so there's actually a double layer here that we don't see as modern readers, that for him to say your sins are forgiven or for him to say you're healed, really you'd have to forgive him before you could heal him. So they really couldn't answer. They're both the same. They go together. And Jesus said that you may know that the Son of Man has the authority to forgive sins. Rise up and walk. And the man stood up in front of him. Yeah. Remember last time Jesus said all judgment has been given over to the Son. Father's given me the authority to be the judge of the human race. And so it is important when Jesus says, I don't condemn you. And so he says, go your way, from now on, sin no more. Boy, this whole story would read very differently if that last line wasn't on there, wouldn't it? You know, without this line, basically this is a story about anything goes. There is no moral authority, and, you know, go for it. But Jesus is not saying that she didn't sin. He's saying she did sin. He's saying he doesn't condemn her for it. And he's calling on her to go and sin no more. Now, let's just think about this a little bit, because I think this is typical of how God works. First of all, let's go through the theological issues that come up in connection with the question, why, if we're forgiven by Jesus, if he's not going to condemn us, then why should we avoid sin? We know that if we accept the death of Christ and we call on God to apply his death to our lives, then we're forgiven for everything past, everything present, and even everything future. Complete and total forgiveness. Now, if that's the case, then why should we avoid sin? And you know, there's several good reasons for that, biblically speaking. In the first place, sin is very damaging. When God says you should not commit adultery, he's not saying this to try to take fun away from people. He's saying that I'm the one that designed you. I know how you work on the inside. And sin is destructive. Every time people can be like, oh, I can do this if I want. I got away with it. Nobody caught me. You know, you never really get away with anything. Because when you commit sin, it damages you inwardly. You're actually tearing the fabric of your extremely sensitive spiritual self when you commit adultery. And God knows that. The reason he says don't do that is because it's like take it easy on yourself. And the other person that you're damaging as well. And all of the prescriptions God gives us are basically to live in accordance with the design, the way we're built, which he knows. If we think we can do the other thing, all we're going to do is shred and tear our inner selves. Sin is very habit-forming. We turn to sinful activities thinking this is going to satisfy my longing. I've got this thirst, this need, and so, I'll just fill up with some sin. The problem is the sin doesn't slake the thirst. It gives you a partial rise to where it seems like you're starting to feel satisfied, but quickly a corresponding drop and low that makes you more desirous than ever to do the same thing again. It's the fact that sin is so unsatisfying. Yes, it's stimulating. There is a thrill to sin. But it's so unsatisfying that all it makes you do is you're never really satisfied. You just have more and more desire, more and more thirst. And these are the dynamics of addiction. We look at our modern world today. Are we in now an unprecedented day of freedom? We have, you know, the sexual revolution has completely changed Western culture. Basically, you know, anything and everything goes. And we're like, oh, yeah, we really got freedom now. I don't think so. I think we live in the day of addiction. It's what we live in. The furthest thing from freedom. The addict is the furthest you could imagine from a free person. The thought that I can be free by engaging in sin is a foolish delusion. Jesus said, anyone who sins is the slave of sin. You become the slave of sin very quickly. Also, sin is alienating. It's alienating because in these sinful acts, which we intuitively know are wrong, there is shame, there is guilt. And it causes us to feel alienated from God. Even if we're under grace, even if we in fact are forgiven, it's kind of hard to believe that about yourself when you've been living in heavy sin. It makes you feel dirty in the presence of God. You feel reluctant to draw close to him because, you know, he is a holy God and I feel like a dirty, grimy, awful, you know, person here. So it's harmful to that relationship. It's alienating to other human relationships as well. I'm hanging around with my friends, you know, at my home church. And they're all acting friendly and stuff. We're joking around, talking. And underlying it is this thought, if only they knew what I was up to last night. That is a very alienating thought. It actually leaves you feeling like people like the image that I put forward, but they have no idea who I really am. And so you feel like there is a distance there. You have an inability to connect with people. It's like you're surrounded with people, but you can't connect with them. And it's because you have a secret self, a second life that they don't know about. And you know that. And we become more and more frenzied to keep it secret and hide it. And it causes distance between people. This is one of the worst things about sin. It breaks down relationship. That's one of the most damaging things about it. Then too, of course, for those of us that are walking Christians, sin is very discrediting. I don't know what you hear from your friends. When I talk to non-Christian friends, probably the word that comes up the most often, the word that comes up the most often in talking with non-Christians about Christianity is the word hypocrite, hypocrisy. That's the biggest complaint that non-Christians have about Christians. And way too often, it's pretty well deserved, too. Why? Sin. Yeah. So there are plenty of good reasons why we, even though we're forgiven, yeah, we can sin and still be accepted by God. That's not the point here. The point is, who wants to damage their lives, shred their relationships, and bring disgrace and contempt upon the name of Jesus? What's so great about that? Second theological point here, I'd like to call your attention to, is the relationship between the two clauses that Jesus threw out here, the two statements. First, neither do I condemn you. Then, go and sin no more. See, that order is very important because this goes right to the essence, to the heart of how God motivates change in the believer's life, which is not by the fear threat motive, but it's by the power of grace. Under law, when we say legalism or law, what do we mean by that? Law is basically, okay, if you live right, if you do this, if you do that, then God will bless you in such and so way. And so basically the blessing of God is always up to me doing, you know, X, Y, and Z. And then I get blessing A, B, and C. So the key determining factor is how I live, my deeds, my works. Grace has a completely different logic. Grace says, since God has loved you, since God has forgiven you, since God does accept you as you are, since God has adopted you as his child, therefore, you should respond to that love with change, changing your life, seeking out change, finding ways to change. The difference? And under law, I'm trying to earn the favor of God. Under grace, I already have his favor. He's already promised that. It's unconditional. It's unchangeable. Now, what am I going to do with it? If I understand the grace of God, I'm going to want to be more like him. I want to be conformed to the image of Christ. No, it doesn't make me feel like going out and wallowing in the gutter in sin. It doesn't make me feel that way at all. So, in this story, this woman, the story doesn't question that she was an adulteress. I mean, that neither her, the accusers, or Jesus questioned that. That was obviously truth. But the implication here is, because of that acceptance, because I do not condemn you, that's what's going to give you the power to go and sin no more. A lot of people don't understand this. It's that God doesn't motivate us by a fear threat motive. That's not how he works. People will say, oh, if you teach this free grace, this cheap grace, then, you know, we're just going to have a wild bunch of sinners running around. Everybody's just going to go crazy for sin. Well, okay, that may be true. I would say that could be true in some cases. That's certainly a risk that God is willing to take. And yet, if you've ever really experienced the grace of God, it certainly doesn't make me feel like running out and going rampant into sin. As a matter of fact, it has the opposite effect. and properly understood, this concept of grace, where God is giving you his love and favor as a free gift without strings attached, and that that becomes the fuel, the engine that drives a change of life. It's more powerful by far than threatening people that, oh, if you sin, oh boy, God's going to get you. It's not really actually motivating at all. In fact, fear-based groups also sin. So we might have some fairly wild sin going on in our church. I guess we do. When you come down to it, it's not as bad as a lot of people claim. But we would like to improve. Still, when you think of a legalistic group, legalism just makes sin more exciting. You know, the stolen fruit, the forbidden fruit is always tastier. Think of what these guys that came, that brought these accusations were from a law-living group. Think what a dastardly, vicious act this is to seize this woman and throw her down like that. When they are perfectly well involved all the way down the line, either lying outright that they caught her in the act, or if they did, then even worse, that they had their own guy probably in there or in cahoots with him. Oh, man, can you imagine what this gal would have felt like cast down in front of this multitude of people who don't like adultery, ancient Jewish people, and she's thrown down like a rag there in front of them. What a vicious, nasty act this was. And all of it, complete BS, because nothing to do here other than try to trap Jesus in a bad reply. That's sin. So you can see raw sin of the most shameful kind, but often kept in a legalistic environment, what happens is people keep the sin secret. You engage in secret sin. You have the double life fundy, which is a fundamentalist Christian who's always a big finger wagger, preacher of sin, and on the side, they're sneaking everything and its brother, complete phony. And that's what you get under the fear-based motivation. The grace-based motivation gives you real change, at least, and it's not fakey, or you're far less likely to fake it. So, the Bible teaches the more we bang away at the law, the worse our lives are going to get on the moral plane. Romans 5:20 says, the law came in that transgression, that sin, might increase, not decrease. Wait, I thought the law came to so people wouldn't sin so much. It's not what it says. Increase. But where sin increased, grace abounded all the more. God always knew that people would never follow the law. He gave the law standard there to provoke the flesh into revolt against God. And that just shows us our need for grace all the more. Romans 7, he says, sin, taking opportunity through the commandment, produced in me coveting of every type. He's talking about the law. You should not covet, should not lust, should not envy other people. And he says, when I look at that law, the law produces more and more coveting. The harder I try to follow it, the more I fall. Yeah, that's the way the law works. And 1 Corinthians 15. He teaches the sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. How poorly that statement fits with legalistic Bible banger preaching to the effect that we all need to be under law so that we won't sin too much. This says that the power of sin is the law. Why would he say that if the law was helpful in getting us out of sin? He's saying the opposite of that. In all of these passages. So this is a deep truth we had to come to grips with if you want to understand how things work in the spiritual realm. God gave the law. The problem is not the law. The problem is our reaction to the law. The fleshly, the fallen nature recoils from the law and cannot follow it. And things actually get worse when we're under law, not better. How does God motivate us? Here's a simple statement in Romans 6:14. This is a good one to remember. Sin shall not be master over you. You're not going to get enslaved to sin. Why? Because you're not under law, but under grace. Take the law out. Relate to God in the basis of pure grace, and all of a sudden that power that sin has to seize your mind, that compulsive drive to sin is like unplugged. And that you'll still get desires, but they're not powerful as like they are under law. Getting ourselves under grace is the most important part of gaining victory over our negative habits and stuff like that in life. We've got to get under the grace of God, and it's got to go all the way down. It takes a lifetime to comprehend this. God will be peeling back layers in your life for years to come, where you will see at a new level how legalistic you really are, how much of your activity is really man-pleasing, how low of view you really have of God, and how little you comprehend of His love. And you just layer after layer peels it back. I'm getting more layers peeled back this year than any year I can remember. And I've been at this for a long time. Maybe you won't take as long as I have, but I'm telling you, it is a very deep, deep principle and profound. This is how God takes us out of slavery to sin. Neither do I condemn you. Now go and sin no more. Yep. It's the transforming power of grace. Or you could say that in place of the power of fear, which has a certain power to at least get external compliance, that's what you get under fear, external compliance. Compliance when the boss is watching, then you look busy, you know. It's not from the heart. It's all show. And what we have here is the power of love. It's really not too simple to say that instead of fear, God uses the motivation of love. It's a response to His love that's the most life-changing thing. So let's apply this passage. The first question to ask, some of you here may not have ever entered into relationship with Christ. You've never actually asked to have His death pay for your sins, to have Him say to you, neither do I condemn you. And so there is a necessity to ask for this. It states in the Bible that to as many as received Him, He gave the right to become children of God. So it's necessary to receive Christ. It's real straightforward. It's just a matter of, you know, in your heart, declaring this intent to God and just saying, I'm ready. I want to be forgiven. I want to have the death of Christ apply to me. You can do that tonight. You can do that right here. There's nothing to wait for because it's as you are. You don't have to change first. You don't have to perform anything. We won't even have you come up and kneel at the altar. Because God sees your heart and you can just talk with Him right there. You should really think about this tonight. Now, those of us that have received grace of God, we already did that, need to also think about and ponder this story and remember, and there's a lesson here. We have to resist tendency to keep falling back into a legalistic mentality for ourselves, where we put ourselves under various types of law. And we're like, well, maybe I'm a little legalistic, but what the hey? And we think, oh, that's not damaging. It is damaging. And it's going to take your whole attention into this external compliance area. You miss the real heart of the issue, which is mostly the inward part. And that's where God makes the real change. So legalism is very damaging and has a blinding effect on you to where you don't see the real issues. Your focus is on the external laws that you're setting up for yourself. Ministry, disciplines that I keep, routines, so on and so forth. And we set these things up and get our focus on that, and then that takes our focus away from the more important inward part. Also, for our friends, we can put one another unintentionally. It's not that we want to put people under law. We're trying to help, but our prescriptions are frankly legalistic, and we're not directing people to the grace of God like we need to. We're telling them, do this, do this, do this. And I'm not saying that external actions aren't good for us at many points. But where is the heart of the focus? Are we regularly taking them back to the foot of the cross, to these steps at the temple where Jesus is saying, neither do I condemn you? That's the key. And yeah. Well, we'll draw the line there on this story.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.